So before the break for news, Rose Dugdale had stole paintings at Rusborough House. Obviously of very high value, obviously high profile paintings. Given her background, you indicated Rose would have known this. So how did she imagine that she would be able to sort of, you know, sell them to raise funds for her cause? Did she try to sell them? What happened? Were the paintings ever recovered? Was Rose ever apprehended?
Well, a very good question. And the thing is, I don't think she was intending to sell them. It was for a ransom. That's what she used. She wrote a letter to the director of James White of the National Gallery of Ireland. And smartly, she had it postmarked and sent from Belfast. So when the Gardaí went to investigate this note, it was a ransom note. And that she wanted four, or it wasn't known who, but we know now it was Rose. She wanted four Republican prisoners released, the Price sisters, Dolores and Marion Price, Jerry Kelly and Hugh Feeney, both men who were on hunger strike in Brixton prison at the time, and she wanted €500 ransom. So this was what she was wanting, to force their release and also to have some money then that the IRA would use. And again, got to remember, that would probably been one of the firsts for that kind of demand to happen in this country, and for the Gardaí and the government at the time to have to consider, well, what are we going to do here? And so basically a nationwide search had begun looking for her. So if you can imagine 1974, you're starting in April 74, she hijacks the helicopter first of all in January 74, and then in April 74 she's now done the robbery. So the media at the time are suggesting that this is Rose Dugdale, this heiress from England, and they indicated that she might have been involved. And so a nationwide search begins, and what they find a few days afterwards was a car abandoned in Tipperary, and they believe then this was used in the Rossborough robbery. And very interesting, some very observant and wise Garda noticed some paperwork that was there, and it was a giveaway. Very simple. When we do a date, you know, if you write the 21st or the 2nd, say 75, she semicolons between them, and that's the old educated system of doing it. If you were educated to the old system, you'd put in semicolons between the dates. We might do a slash or a dash. And they found that was written on the pieces of paper in the car, and it was the same style that was used in the visitor's book and Got a Hark for Stephanie Grant.
So they were able to use the visitor's book as confirmation that this was her, at least it led the investigation in a very firm direction.
So it gives a meaning to the word joining up the dots.
Yeah,
so
quite. Joining up the semicolons.
Very bright guard that had figured that out.
So and apprehended then, was she, and charged with this crime?
Yeah, so they went searching for her and they did a nationwide search, and eventually they came across her down in Galway. She'd been renting a house, and the man that had rented out the house did, Con Hayes at the time, did report that they had left and returned very late the night of the robbery. So they assumed then this was Rose. And so she stood trial in 74, and she just said proudly and incorruptibly, I'm guilty. Yes, absolutely. And so she was taken to the criminal court in November 74 and charged and found guilty on 5 charges of the hijacking Got a Hark. And she was sentenced to 9 years imprisonment. And Patrick Feeney, that was with her, and Eamon McNulty were both given 6 years at this stage.
Did that include the helicopter hijacking and the dropping of the bombs? Okay. Now, she was pregnant, when she was sent to prison? Is that proven or speculated, or what's the story?
She was in a relationship with Eddie, and unbeknownst to the prison authorities. And again, Rose was an amazing person insofar as she was very confident in her own abilities, and she didn't bother telling anybody that she was pregnant, the prison authorities or the courts. And it was just days before her giving birth, she was started to go into labour in the prison. They didn't know what to do, so she gave birth in the prison. And Eddie was the father, Eddie Gallagher. And so on the 12th of December 73, she gave birth to a son, Rory. So she was the first female prisoner to give birth in prison. And then at that time, Eddie Gallagher was trying to get her released. And Eddie, along with Marion Coyle, it's a, people might remember this, in October 75, there was a big heist, or an industrialist, Tidemer Herman, he was captured by the IRA, but it was Eddie and Marion, and there was an 18-day siege. He was a big industrialist from Castletroy in Limerick. And they hijacked him, or kidnapped him, sorry, and they put a ransom in that they wanted Rose released. This was their request. It ended up that Eddie was captured and Marion, and he would then be subsequently tried and sent to jail. So in sometime later in January 24th, 1978, Eddie and Rose got married in jail.
Was he incarcerated at that time?
Yes.
Okay.
And the young boy, their young son Rory, he was about three at the time, and he was there at the wedding. And it reminded me a wee bit of Joseph Mary Plunkett, you know, that he met and married Rose Dugdale at midnight, and he was executed at 4 o'clock in the morning. Well, they were allowed 5 hours of a honeymoon, and then he had to go back to his prison. He was escorted back to his prison. So she was released in October 1980 from prison. So she'd spent a good time in prison. Yeah, 6 years. Yeah. And Eddie remained in prison to 1990. So she had been out.
But their relationship broke down.
Yes, and at that stage, then she.
That is
she
one little pattern that I do see. Where if her other half is in jail, the relationship doesn't tend to last very long.
Well, that may be true, yeah. And she met this Donegal man, Jim Monaghan. He was from Rathmullen. He was known as Martyr Jim. Martyr Jim, yeah, right, and he was one of the men behind making explosives for the IRA. This is what Shannon O'Driscoll in his book talks about, and so she was in awe of him, and she fell in love with him and wanted to have a family with him, and even considered adopting a child with him. And but one thing another, she got involved with him in bomb making for the IRA. And she discovered that there was a famous story told about it's Ballycorry 3-4. They lined up a series of bombs on a beach in Mayo, Ballycrory Beach, and they detonated each one, and they found that number 3 and 4 were the most effective.
Mm.
So they knew the mixture in each, so they continued then to develop the Ballycrory
3-4. And what bombs did they make, or what were they used for, or what was the intention?
Well, those bombs that she specialised both herself and Jim in for the IRA, at Glenanne Barracks in May 1991, it killed 3 soldiers and injured 11. And later the Baltic Exchange, that caused about £800 million worth of damage. It killed a number of people as well. So those were the bombs that were used for those events. And again, it's believed, you know, Rose didn't kill anybody directly, but her bombs, it could be argued, did.
They did, yeah, and I think you could argue that she did as well in making and transporting those bombs. Obviously then the peace process, that part of our history, thankfully, came to an end, that type of activity, and hopefully long may it continue. Yeah. Where did she settle, and did she continue to live out her life with Jim Monaghan?
Yeah, well, she went to live in Dublin, she ended up, from what I understand, as an older woman living in Dublin on her own and a pensioner. But she was very much involved with Shell to Sea. She was very much involved with anti-drug movement in Dublin.
Social issues.
Yeah, she continued to remain very articulated and to represent what she considered social injustice. And she lived a simple life, had only a pension like any other pensioner, and seemed to have gone a little bit out of the limelight in so far as IRA activities.
Did she ever put her head above the parapet in the media? Would she have been ever featured in...
No, like, she was always very educated and articulated, and was very, very competent. But at the same time, she was a very private person and seemed not to want to engage the media. And so people trying to interview her, she wasn't always making herself that readily.
But she never wrote a book or anything? Or no, do we have any of her life in her words?
No, as I said, there's a number of books written about her. The Woman Who Stole the Vermeer by Anthony Amore, but probably one of the best books is written by Shannon O'Driscoll, who did interview her, The Heiress, Rebel, Vigilante and Bomber, The Extraordinary Life of Rose Dugdale. And he managed to get a terrible lot of information and interviewed her. So that was that's a very insightful book. But she
how do we? Because often when we talk about women or men in history, Joe, you know, it could be back 150, 200 years. You know, and when we talk of the struggle and the action they took. You know, it can often, because of the passage of time and the fact that no one directly affected is still alive, this is a little bit different. This is contemporary history, right? And we know by her own words what she's admitted to and what she's responsible for. But that was part of the troubles. We're now this side of the peace process. How do we judge her? How do we frame her? Is she a hero? Is she a villain? You know, I mean, some of her actions had really quite devastating consequences for people's, you know, great uncles or grandfathers, the people that are alive today. So where does she sit in history at this stage?
Well, look, when we live in an area where we know, and your radio listenership extends into particularly the six counties, and look, people have suffered and we've had loss. So there's nothing glorious about the killing of people. But look, history is history and we have to understand it in its context and its time. Like Michael Collins and Bloody Sunday, we all kind of remember Bloody Sunday, the GA field and the British soldiers going in. But what people fail to realise, and I say this as a Republican, that morning Michael Collins had his Cario gang go out and execute, summarily execute 14 British officers. There was nothing glorious about that. Mm. He sent them out on a mission and they did that. This is our history. And Michael Collins would be considered one of the greatest, you know, men of Irish history.
We always presume too, people's motivations, not talking of Michael Collins, we always presume people's motivations are righteous. Do we ever consider that maybe it's bad people that see a cause to inflict harm and damage on people? And
I think that could be true, but when you look at the longer picture and you see like where Michael Collins tried to bring the country...
No, I wasn't talking about Michael Collins, more of Rose.
Yeah. I'm just using him as an example. You could take Nelson Mandela. Like Nelson Mandela was in the ANC and then he started up the Spear of the Nation, which was kind of a military end of the ANC, and he ended up going to jail. I mean, that Spear of a Nation group did kill people, 300-400 people as terrorists, so... Like, it depends how you look at it. Someone's hero could be another person's terrorist, but we have to try to understand it from the time we live in. And in fairness, you know, I've listened to Patrick McLaughlin and Niall Blaney in particular, that conversation. They talk about this truth commission and that we need to talk to tell the truth. We have to tell the truth, even if it's painful, even if it's sore on us to hear it. But particularly with Northern Ireland, the six counties, we need to hear both sides.
Yes,
and
quite true.
The horrific things that were done, we talk about them, and it's only by talking that healing can...
But also to how we receive it. This is a by the by. A lot of us watch documentaries, historical documentaries, documentaries on murder or what have you, and a lot of it's recent. And whilst we go, you know, that's terrible what happened, it is entertainment. And in a way, our conversation, it's not glorifying what Rose is responsible for. If people find it entertaining, of course, we like learning about history, we like learning about people, but it's important we talk of history because someone else will write it.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it's to try to understand, and for particularly for our young people, history is very important because it allows you to educate younger people to understand the past. And if you don't understand the past, you make the same mistakes again. So, look, she was a very genuine woman. She sold her house and gave away her wealth. She was a real sincere woman in that regard. And she obviously was very sincere about
her... She gave over her life to it, if the truth be told. I mean,
her
adult life was dedicated to this.
But the question then is, was all that worth it in the end when we see where we are with the peace process? And again, for me personally, I think peace isn't just the absence of wrongdoing or the absence of things, not violence. It's not that. Peace is something that you have to work at. And I can say my own self, I teach it in secondary school to my children every year, and I find it a very hard chapter to deal with, is the troubles. It's a part of the course.
Of course.
And I can honestly say that to some degree, I've been traumatized in a very light way as a young man, a young boy growing up, because every morning I got up in my house with my father and I listened to every news every morning, and I heard this taxi man killed, that soldier shot, and I grew up hearing of that nearly every day, that there was murder and killing and violence. That was the news that I grew up to as a young fella. And I never really understood that until I started to teach it and realised, God, this impacted my understanding of myself and my country.
Yes, I get you.
And there's nothing heroic. Bertie Ahern was very correct when, you know, the ooh-ah up the ra. There's nothing glorious about the troubles that were in Northern Ireland. There's nothing glorious about the violent struggle. And it's happened, and this is where the truth needs to be discussed. Mm. And for one reason or other, people got involved on both sides. But we need to heal, and we need to talk, and we need to find a way forward.
Sure.
And I was very impressed. My father took me home a book one time, and I was only a young fellow, and I read it, and I memorized the front of the beginning of the book. It was Father Niall O'Brien, who was a missionary in the Philippines. And maybe I'll leave you with this thought. And there's a beautiful line that I've known for, I memorized it right away. Violence is a source that sources injustice. Violence is the fruit of the tree of injustice, and evil is its hated flower. If we want to remove violence, we must first remove injustice. Mm-hmm. Anywhere you find violence, the root of the whole thing is injustice.
Okay.
And society must work at ensuring that injustice is removed at every level. And I think, in fairness, Rose tried to do that, and many others.
Dr. Joe Kelly, historian, thank you. That was Rose Dugdale. See you soon. Enjoy your Easter weekend. God bless.
Sam.
Margie White. We are back in the garden now with Paul McLaughlin of Balloch-Durrand Garden Centre. Normal service has resumed after our glorious couple of weeks, albeit chilly. You know,
yes.
we're not roasting during the day, and certainly chilly enough at night, Paul.
Yeah, pretty much. But it was still a lovely wee spell that we got there.
Gorgeous.
And hopefully there's only a blip now.
Did you see an uptick in interest in the garden down at Balloch-Durrand Garden
Centre?
Huge
amount of interest, all right. We've been very busy, thankfully, for the last week or so. So it has just, people are in all winter in that, and they're like, just itching to get out, if you know what I mean. So whenever the good weather comes, every spot and wee jabs need done around the garden.
This weather is a bit, in fact, I don't think it's quite as cold at night, but it's not as cold during the day, and we're seeing a bit of rainfall. Is that going to promote growth?
It should promote growth, all right. You should see grass starting to actively grow from now on. Even you can see certain fields now. You see the grass actively growing and everything. So if you are doing a bit of lawn care, that now's a perfect time, the week coming, because the grass will be actively growing, so it will actually take up the stuff a lot better.
Brilliant. There's a splash of pink across the county as well, I see on my travels. What's going on there?
Yes, this kind of down these couple of weeks, and because the good weather's brought it on now, the Prunus Canzana, the Flowering Cherry, is out at the minute, and they're looking amazing. They are. Funny, I was in Stranorner last night there, and as you go out towards Kelly Garden out that road, they're just clattered in them. It's lovely looking, actually.
Yeah, they are. And what's their lifespan like?
The lifespan of the trees are actually, as a tree grows, they'd be quite short lifespan.
In terms of the flowering?
Flowering. Depends on the weather. Generally, you're chatting 2 to 3 weeks.
Is that it? Once a year?
Yes, once a year.
Wow.
But it's amazing whenever it is out. Actually, in Japanese culture, where they come from, they're a symbol of fleeting beauty.
Mm.
So they are.
Yes. That's how some people describe me. I was fleetingly beautiful. No, never. Right, okay. They're beautiful. But it's a shame the display is short, isn't it? And they're called the Japanese...
They're a flowering cherry. There'd be a Prunus Kanzan would be the proper name. But they'd be very much associated with Japan.
If anyone spotted them and fancies putting them in around their place, are they handy got? When do you plant them?
Yeah, plant them anytime. Generally, they're available in pots. You can plant them anytime.
They work well here, do they?
Yeah, work well here and work very well. They're actually, the flowers would be short-lived, but they're actually quite strong trees. Mm. So even in an exposed site, they would be quite a good option.
But there are splashes of colour throughout the year once the blossoms have passed.
Yeah. Exactly. So you have, generally, they're so striking because the flowers come before the leaves almost, or come at the same time.
Yeah.
So they have nothing. But now, from now on, they'll come out. They come out almost red at the start. Then they turn green for the summer, and then they turn sort of browny gold for the winter time.
Brilliant. Okay. So if you're looking for them, they're called Prunus Kanzan.
Yes. There are a lot of different varieties now available, like different colours. You have whites into deeper pinks, almost purples.
Brilliant stuff. Right. So I have some herb. Mm-hmm. Beside me here.
Yes.
What have we got here? That's mint, is it?
That's mint there. That's actually apple mint.
Mm-hmm.
So you can chance it there. But funny, in the last year or so, I don't know whether it's to do with cooking or whether it's to do with gardening, but huge interest in herbs at the minute.
Mm.
So there is now.
I think it's accessibility.
Yes, pretty much. We pot at the back door, so if you are cooking something, but people are sort of getting more into their cooking.
What's this?
That's thyme.
Can I eat it raw?
Yes, you can. That'll go with your steak.
Mm-hmm.
Be quite a strong flavour of it.
That's right. I like strong flavour.
Yeah. So there would be. So now herbs, very easy to grow, and very what I got, very easy to grow, and don't take a lot of space. So
that's nice. This one,
yeah, that's oregano. Funny, I wouldn't be wild with eating it raw.
No, so, but I,
I wouldn't be wild with eating it raw.
It's why?
That's very sort of perfumey almost.
Okay, like but that, so. I make curries and I put a lot of this in my curries.
Yes. Right, perfect. And what I got, the other one there for your curries actually.
I like that.
See the silver one, Dan.
Yep,
that's actually called a curry plant.
Okay,
so it's right. Actually just rub it through your fingers and smell it there. It smells very much of curry.
Oh wow, so yeah.
Does, but you can actually chop that up and put it in your salads if you're fond of the
curry.
Smells
like McDonald's curry sauce.
Yeah, pretty much. So it does. But very popular plant that. So it does.
I'm going to nibble a bit of it anyway, and I'll probably put it in.
Yeah, but no, hugely.
This wee one, this wee book.
Oh, that's the time again, I think.
Is it?
Yeah.
No, is it? Well, have I had that?
Oh, no, there are two different oreganos there.
Okay, this is another one here?
Yeah.
Okay, so. It's amazing, you know, when you taste the herbs, the likes of the thyme and, well, all of them really, but that's the distinctive, that's the distinctive flavour of a lot of what we eat.
Yes,
you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, right. Like you put curry on, like you make a curry, right, unless you put coriander on it, it doesn't feel like an authentic curry, especially if you're making it sort of from in the Indian style.
Yes, even for the Italian stuff, like even making your own homemade pizzas and that, like starting with a wee bit of fresh basil or something.
Absolutely love that. That's nice. And that's from your garden, your own stuff, is it? Really brilliant. Do you use it much for cooking?
Oh, would use. Very rosemary would be the big one. Would actually have a couple of like rosemary shrubs almost in the backyard, but it'd be used almost, well, maybe not daily, but weekly anyway.
Hi, Paul. What do you do with daffodils when they've stopped flowering? We've touched on this a couple of times, and what you do next is really important to how what you get next year.
Yes, pretty much. It's important to let them die back naturally, not cut them off, because that's the energy for next year, if you know what I mean. So as long as you can stand looking at them, just sort of let them die back naturally, and that you'll have a far better display for next year.
This is probably one that could have slipped into the slot with Seamus Gunn. My neighbour's trees are growing over into my lawn. I asked him to cut them and he refuses. Do I have a right to cut what is on my land?
Right. Yes, would be the short answer.
The problem here is that you are going to start chopping your neighbour's tree.
Yes.
And there's obviously already a little bit of cooperation gap.
Yes.
Because they won't cut what... So you're going down a road here.
Yes.
You need to sort of know where you're going with this.
Absolutely. Obviously, talking would be the main point if you could. But if it's not working out, you have the right to cut down anything overhanging your anything overhanging your garden, just as far as the boundary. So you're allowed to cut...
Do you know... Sorry, this is probably more of a legal question again. In terms of shade, are you entitled to sunlight, I wonder?
Sunlight's a funny one.
Yeah.
So it has... Sunlight, your entitlement to light... comes from, first of all, it covers the house, doesn't cover the garden.
If your garden's shaded,
that's not a thing. But in terms of your windows of that, you have to be able to prove that you had 20 years of light before the tree grew, say, or before something was done. So if you buy the house, move into the house after the tree is there, the tree wins, if you know what I mean. So yeah, haven't really an automatic right to light unless it's been taken away from you.
But you can cut back whatever's on your boundary. What then if the tree starts dying back or something, or is there any...
That could be problematic as well. You're allowed to cut back within a view to... You can cut back to the boundary, but you're not allowed to do anything that's going to permanently damage the tree.
Mm-hmm.
Like, 'cause a lot of people would even think of cutting off roots or even applying, say, weed killer to the roots.
Yeah, well...
That's obviously going to travel back into the tree.
And
so
it's not going to be helpful to your neighbourly relations.
No,
you have to live
not.
Beside each other.
Yeah. And another wee point in that is, you actually legally you have to offer the clippings back to the person who owns the tree. They don't have to take them by any means, but you have to offer them.
I just wonder if the question has been phrased correctly, whether the person has gone in and say, look, the issue here is your parts of your tree that are on my land, you know. Maybe revisit the conversation before taking any action.
But even from a garden center point of view, it's a question you would get asked weekly.
Really?
Yeah.
There you go. That was a bit of a curveball.
It's a common enough problem.
Okay. My garden has large weeds solid in the ground. When I pull out the root, it leaves a large hole. I cover it with clay, but they just regrow. How do I kill them off without killing the grass?
Yes, it can be difficult getting rid of sort of established weeds like that.
But they think they're taking them out root and all, but obviously they're not.
Yes, I would say even it's amazing how small a piece of root of a weed can actually regrow, if you know what I mean. So the notion would be just dig a slightly bigger hole, try and get as much as you can. Right with the clay. If that doesn't work, you could possibly go down the road of a weed killer. Just sort of doing a spot treatment, if you know what I mean. But if weed killer is not someone you want to go down that road, just sort of digging a bigger hole and taking as much of the route as
Once and for all, because it seems it's a problem they're revisiting, so might as well try and eliminate the root cause of it, huh?
Oh, yes. I see what you did there.
Oh, sometimes I don't even have to think about this content, it just comes out of me. Are foxgloves poisonous, asks a listener.
Yes. That's the simple answer. Digitalis would be one of the... It actually would be renowned for being sort of in your pyro sort of days. I think it's one of the poisons that would be used in like Agatha Christie sort of stuff. It would be quite poisonous.
Can you replant the end of a scallion stalk? And if so, well, you can plant it, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the question is, the big question is, will it grow back?
Yes. I assume they mean the sort of wee bit with the roots at the bottom that you don't eat. Mm. Yeah, if you do plant that, it will come back up again, but... Whether you'd be actually any quicker with it doing it that way rather than starting with seeds, that I wouldn't be 100% sure.
A caller wants to get on top of the weed problem. How can a gardener manage weeds effectively as they begin to emerge?
Yes. Well, I suppose removal would be the key here. As the old saying is, one weed is 1,000 seeds. If the actual weed gets to the point where it sets seed, you obviously have a huge problem for next year, even later on that season. So keeping on top of the removal, keeping on top of the weeding.
The weed killer options there. Is weed killer... Are all weed killers as controversial as I suspect they might be?
Yes, well, there are a few options there. Well, obviously, Roundup is the bad word at the minute, so it is, and pretty much it's proven to be sort of harmful.
I bet
to a
it's
lot
the
of
most
stuff.
Effective, though.
It is the most effective by far. I think glyphosate-based would be, but then it is very harmful to to the bees and stuff like that, so it's just a lot of people are steering away from it. There are ones that you can make up to be classed as organic that you can make up. It's a mixture of vinegar, Epsom salts, and fairy liquid. You can mix it up yourself. You get a recipe for it.
Will that
there.
Kill weeds, though? And will it kill them quick enough that, you know, weed killer can work quite slow. And sometimes you wonder, whilst that's working, more weeds are coming. And that's even if you buy shop-bought weed killer. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Like, a lot of the time, the sort of vinegary stuff, it kills what's above the ground, but it doesn't kill the roots. So you're really just sort of maintaining as much as anything else. So active removal, like literally taking them or digging
that
them out.
Is the most effective outside of weed killers and everything that goes along with them. What flowers can I plant now to ensure a vibrant summer display for a wedding in August? They've got a wedding coming up and they want the property to be looking colourful and brilliant.
Yes, pretty much there are a few things. If you're going for the ground, you have like say geums or something like that, it's going to flower the whole way through the summer. Mm. Even that aloe maestria or something like that there would be great for the ground. If you're going for pots, probably the key there would be petunias, would be the main one. Generally, if you want it, they're available in all sorts of different...
Do you time it though?
Not really. If you plant, like the sort of summer bed in the beginning, like we've been asked for it all last week, but it's too cold yet. So sort of through the month of May. If you plant them through the month of May and maintain them through the summer, they will be looking
spectacular. Are people calling in for things for hanging baskets and stuff now? Too early for
that,
really?
Yeah. Just as the cold at night.
Which is not easy as a business to say, look, lads, I know you've had the sun and we all want to get a bit of colour, but it's just not suitable yet.
But now even if for the flowers there, if you're looking for certain stuff for pots, hanging baskets, even you consult your garden centre. At the minute they're all full and they're getting stuff in. So you could even get someone, if you have a colour theme for the wedding or something like that, you could actually get someone to match. You know, so
maybe the bridesmaids' dresses and
exactly.
What
so,
have you,
so if you just consult your local garden centre, there's loads of options there.
Okay, what can go in the ground vegetable wise in April?
Loads of stuff. April kind of is main sort of month for it, if you know what I mean. So your potatoes, peas, beans, onions, cabbages, all that sort of stuff.
Great stuff. Perfect. All the good stuff.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much anything you plant in April is going to be happy enough.
Great stuff. What tips do you have for protecting young plants from late spring frost? We're going to have to presume it's outside, right?
Yes.
If it's inside, there might be central heating or what have you. Yeah, so maybe they've young plants out.
Yeah, pretty much. Funny, a lot of people think they're frost on plants. That is, they're like, no, back in January, whenever it's like -8 thing does damage. But it's actually usually now that the frost would happen. Because the new buds come out in the plants.
Makes them more vulnerable.
Frost. Like, it only get down to zero maybe, but it would actually do out the plants. So you get stuff in the garden centre called horticultural fleece. It's like a very fine fabric that you just sort of drape over the plants. You could secure it with a couple of stones, even if you have them in a bed. Just cover the whole bed on nights that are forecast to be frosty. And it's like, it's a reusable product and it's not expensive.
All right. Caller wants to know, what plants would you recommend to grow that give space and food for insects and birds?
Yes, once again, there are huge options available, if you know what I mean. So a lot of the flowering plants are going to sort of provide nectar and pollen for insects as food. It's also important to get a few plants in that actually would provide shelter for them, if you know what I mean. So you'd have stuff like Forsythia there. The branches would be hollow on the inside, almost like a briar, and that'll provide a place for even solitary bees to live. So just if the sort of the list endless pretty much. But yeah. Heather's always a good one for the ground actually because bees and insects love it at the minute.
Brilliant.
It's quite early flowering, so it's very good for, as it's early flowering, it's a very good source of pollen whenever the hive actually is established and it needs it, if you know
what I mean. Lovely that people are being more considerate and more understanding of our environment, you know, and that comes over years of sort of people like yourself and others trying to educate people to the importance of bees and what have you, but also options outside of having a pristine lawn as
yes,
well.
Yes, exactly.
What last one on that daffodils? I know you said you can let them die down because they need the food for next year. Does that include not deadheading them? Leave them as is. They're going to go away anyway.
Pretty much, they're going to fade off anyway. If you know what I mean. So no, it's not actually that deadheading them. It's not going to do them a lot of harm.
It's exercise.
Pretty much, yeah, it's, yeah. There's no real advantage to it.
All right, brilliant stuff, Paul, as always. Thanks so very much indeed. Our second slot of the year. Paul McLaughlin, Ballacdur Garden Centre in Letterkenny. Paul, down at Ballacdur Garden Centre and the crew there. Love to have you in. Asking questions, take pictures in, they'll give you advice. It's the same of all our brilliant garden centres that we have sprinkled across the Northwest. They love helping and talking to people and discussing flowers and plants and what have you. Paul, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you, Greg.
We'll be back with more after these. Okay, so as we discussed in the first hour, the terms woman and sex in Britain's Equality Act refer to a biological woman and biological sex. The UK Supreme Court has ruled this means transgender women with a gender recognition certificate can be excluded from single-sex spaces if proportionate. Here in Ireland, the Gender Recognition Act 2015 allows transgender people to legally recognise their gender by applying to the state. This process, open to those 18 and over, involves a self-declaration of gender identity requiring no medical intervention. A gender recognition certificate is then issued, which can also include a new name if desired. You can then get your name changed on your birth cert and then live out your life in this country and using women's facilities. Courtney joins me on the programme now to discuss this. Hi, Courtney.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm good. I am conscious of when I'm discussing issues, you know, important issues, Courtney, that, mm-hmm. you know, in sort of, you know, obviously, it's hurting people. I don't want to hurt people. Does that make sense? You know,
I
know it's a really important topic, right? But I also know that there are people, whether people agree with them or not, that are living what they believe to be their real authentic lives as themselves. And sometimes in the discourse, that can get forgotten. And I don't want to cause any pain to anyone, especially the marginalised. But obviously there are wider issues here as well, and we also have to look at the rights of women and girls and all of that. But I'll try and tread carefully. What is your view on the court ruling yesterday? Do you agree, disagree? What's your takeaway from it?
Well, I just wanted to get in touch, Greg, just because, and I know as you say there, you're not trying to hurt anyone or, you know, like invalidate anyone's opinions or anything. But I just felt this morning that there was a lot of people that seemed to be in favour of the, you know, of what happened yesterday. Whereas it would be my opinion that, you know, a transgender woman is a woman the same way I am as a biological woman. You know, they mightn't have the biological characteristics, but you know, they have the right to live with dignity and safety and have full participation in public life the same as the rest of us. And I think excluding them from women-only spaces just sends a message that they're not real women,
and
you know,
which is
a bit of discrimination.
In terms of transgender women, in your view, do you differentiate between, say, for instance, a transgender woman who has had surgery or not? Do you, you know, does that matter to you in how you view someone?
No, it wouldn't. In my personal opinion, it wouldn't matter to me in how I view someone, you know, whether they've medically transitioned or whether they've just, you know, transitioned with the, you know, the legal side of things with a bit of paper or anything. I feel like that side of it doesn't really, in my opinion, doesn't really need to come into things until we're talking about things like sports and, you know, things where hormone levels might need to be monitored a bit.
Okay. So in terms of, say, for instance, women-only spaces. Now, there's this presumption that in changing rooms, everyone's walking around completely naked. You know, I mean, often people are very discreet.
We're not at that.
Or they use, men or women for that matter, Courtney, you know, often they use cubicles or some people are more discreet, others are more comfortable in themselves. But with all that being said, are you comfortable with trans women in women-only spaces, such as changing rooms, hospital wards, you know, not just with adult women like you, Courtney, who can make your own decisions, but also maybe young girls, 5, 6, 7 years of age. And we have seen cases, and it's possible that as part of that, male genitalia may be on show. Are you happy with that?
Yeah, I personally, I would be comfortable with that, especially when it's children. I like, you know, if we're talking about like a children's changing room, there's an innocence there, you know, no genitals being shown in a bad way. And in my experience in, you know, female changing rooms and female only areas, I've never felt unsafe or any other kind of way around a trans woman. Like, and the thing is, you wouldn't know who is a trans woman and who isn't, because as you say, we're not, like the majority of us anyway, we're not walking around changing rooms, you know, in our birthday suits. We're being a bit more you know, covered up, like.
No,
but I think
that
being denied access to them kind of spaces for trans women is going to cause like serious emotional distress, you know, and they're going to feel like, well, I can't speak for all trans people, only people I know, but they're going to feel unsafe going into, if they have to be forced to go into a men's bathroom when they identify and look like a woman. You know, in my experience as a biological woman, I've never felt unsafe around women, only men.
Okay, but in the case of your trans female friend, for an example, though, they would be one person feeling uncomfortable going into a male's dressing room, right? Let's just say there isn't any gender-neutral dressing rooms. But there could be five women in the women's changing room that feels uncomfortable at that person's presence. So how do we balance up the rights, the hard-won, hard-fought-for rights of women that, you know, a biological male, as defined by the... I'm not being emotive in that language, just as defined by...
Oh, no,
England,
I know.
Yeah. A biological male is now allowed into that space. Do you know what I mean? But it's to protect that person from feeling uncomfortable in the men's space. Do you get where I'm coming from?
So I do. I get, like, what you're coming
it
at.
It feels like the trans person's rights are elevated above all women and girls that may be uncomfortable, to avoid uncomfortable situation for themselves.
See, I do. I get where you're coming from, Greg. But in my eyes, and I know in a lot of people's eyes, I wouldn't see trans women as a separate entity. Mm. I see them as women. I see the hard fought for women's rights as trans women's rights as well. You know, I feel like we're all included under that. You know, and things like that Equality Act are meant to protect people like trans women from discrimination based on, you know, their gender reassignments. And I think to any biological woman who would feel unsafe in a public area with transgender women, I would ask them to like question that in themselves, because like, there's no credible evidence that, like, all trans women pose a greater threat in these spaces than biological women.
No, there are, but you do get, and it seems more common now than it was in the past, you know, transgender lesbians. And you know where there's no estrogen taken, for an example. There's no operations that are taken, so you could have a biological male in a female's changing room who's attracted to females changing with girls and women. That's something that is part of it.
I think to look at it like that, well, then it would pose the point, like, should lesbians, you know, biological women, lesbians, be allowed in changing rooms as well, if they're also, you know, looking at females in a way, you know, they're not. I don't think anyone, well, obviously I can't speak for anyone, there's bad people out there, but I think they exist amongst all
because
the
another
different
group
genders
of individuals that have had to sort of redefine themselves are lesbian women. Because now you obviously, and I've seen it myself, lesbian women are being called out and being accused of being transphobic because they won't date transgender women.
Yeah, and like, that's, you know, I can't speak to that because, like, I identify as a straight woman, you know, so I can't understand necessarily from their point of view there. But
what about the role? I get that then. So what about the role then of trans women in sport? You know, in the darts, you'll see that you know, there's a small amount of women's spaces in men's competitions, and recently a trans female dart player has secured that position. You'll know the high profile case where in a fencing competition, a woman refused because she thought there was a competitive advantage to take on a biological male last week. Two biological males contested a women's pool final, and then there is concerns that medals are being taken from women by transgender females, and that's seen unfair. Do you believe any of that's unfair?
I do think it's a very complex issue when we go into sports. For me personally, my views would be that I know there's a couple of sporting organizations in America that already have like rules in place that would involve hormone level requirements or, you know, like a transition timeline. You know, when did this person transition? You know, when did they start taking estrogen and things like that? So that people can be tested to see, you know, if that balances out of what a biological woman, you know, the hormone she has in her body. I think there is a way to do these things to make it fair to, you know,
it
to have biological
like,
women.
It sounds
be
though like because everyone says, you know, the trans population is in and around 1 or 2%, say 1%, right? It does seem that Courtney, women are being asked an awful lot, and to be very understanding and to be very caring to accommodate a relatively small amount of people that can have quite large impacts in sport, for an example. Do you know what I mean? It's a lot of women having to make these sacrifices and to be accepting.
I just personally, Greg, I just don't, just from my own point of view, you know, I know everyone feels differently about it, but I just don't agree with that. To me, trans women are women. You know, it might be biologically,
no, that's
but that's they
great.
Identify
and
they
view,
live
yeah.
as a woman, you know?
And I think, again, to reiterate,
I
think to reiterate too, it's really important in this conversation, I think, that we make sure to understand that we're talking about a group of people. They may well be listening to this program
today.
Of course. They may feel, you know, we don't want those people to feel, you know, I don't want to hurt anyone. Is all I'm,
no, we don't want no one to feel belittled by our views, you know. Yeah, of course.
All right.
You know, everyone deserves respect at the end of the day. I think that's all that it's about, is making sure everyone is respected and everyone's identity is valid, you know. And I just think a lot of people I've been hearing talking about this, I think, could just do with, you know, educating themselves a little bit. There's a lot of stuff going around online that is just completely spewed out of nowhere, you know. A lot of, as your man Donald said, a lot of fake news, you know. I think people should just read up on it and get the facts, not just what people are talking about in town.
All right, listen, thanks for that, Courtney. I really appreciate
Perfect.
The alternative
thanks
point
for
of view
me on,
and it's only alternative in terms of the voices we've heard so far on the topic. John, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. How you doing?
I'm all right. What's your reaction been to yesterday's court ruling in the convo?
Not before time that Britain started to wake up to the rest of the world, to the same as the likes of Donald Trump. One of his first things that he changed: a male's a male, a female's a female, end off. And it needs to be drummed into the people's heads. Greg, I don't care what you are. I do not care what you are. But when it comes to sports, or when it comes to activities like that there, if you were born with male hormones and male, and you're entering into a woman's competition, you're obviously going to be stronger, you're obviously going to be fitter, you're obviously, I personally think, make up a Special Olympics for them. We also already have a Special Olympics for special needs people. Make up a Special Olympics for these types of people.
They don't have to. I mean, if you want to go down the route, you know, you can participate. A trans woman who's a biological male can take part in male events, and a trans male can take part in female events. So there are categories. My point is you can still take part in activities aligned to your birth gender. You don't need a special category for trans athletes or sports. Anyway, there's not enough of them to justify that.
So Greg, if that's the case, then why do we have special needs events? Why can't somebody with a special needs compete in the normal Olympics?
Well, they could if they could qualify, obviously.
But you see my point. At the end of the day, Greg, if we don't start pointing this out for what it is, it's a mental health issue. It's attention seeking. I would say the majority of it's social media influence for attention seeking. They weren't getting attention seeking as a man, so they decided to try it as a woman, or vice versa. It's a serious illness. They need support. They need help. They definitely need all those things put into place. But at the end of the day, thank God Britain has woke up to it, and fair play to Scotland to allow this thing to happen in the courts. We're starting to get the people back their voices.
The Scottish government opposed this right up until the Supreme Court.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is thank God we're starting to get our voices back, because we can't open our mouths regardless of anything. Now, you're either homophobic or you're against trans and all this. Greg, at the end of the day, I don't give a damn. There's a lot of things that has to be stopped, and such as, I don't know if you've seen some of the social media things with in primary schools and them, oh my God, teaching nursery rhymes about trans. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I am so sorry, Greg. Enough's enough. And I'm so glad that maybe society is maybe taking a wee step back and going, no, do you know what? Thank God we're starting to wake up to this. And I hope to God that this is the start, and I hope the EU will follow on. Where the EU won't, because the EU's kind of very, I don't know, they're very corrupt and everything they seem to be doing at the minute. But I would love if we followed the same as Britain. I love America. Yes, I don't like some of his policies, but for me, a man's a man, a woman's a woman.
All right,
no matter how many operations you have.
That's exactly what the Supreme Court has ruled. John, thanks for your time. I appreciate it so much.
Bye. Thank you for having me on.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Right, now, just by the way, if you're listening to the podcast or if you're listening to the replay overnight, we really want your views as well, and we want you to be part of that conversation. You don't just have to message or text when we're live. So if you are listening overnight to the podcast, feel free to email your views to comments@highlandradio.com or send us a WhatsApp, and hopefully we'll pick that up to include on the next live show, which will be Tuesday, because as is traditional, we're off tomorrow, Good Friday, and we're off public holiday Monday. We're back on Tuesday. So for me, Greg Hughes, and the rest of the team, have a fantastic, fantastic weekend, and stay safe.